Got to be careful. You're going to blast us out of there. You know, you just kind of came blowing through there, bud.
Yeah, how are you? I guess the microphone was not on. Yeah, I'm here. Sorry about that. Yeah, I'm in the UK. I'm in the north. I'm in the north of the country.
Okay, you are. So things are going good up there in the UK. A lot of snow and all that stuff. You guys trying to stay dry?
Yeah, we've had a bit of a cold spell, but the weather's been okay. I can't complain. I'm used to really cold weather. I lived a few years in northern Sweden when I was younger playing ice hockey. So I'm used to kind of minus 40 degree winters. So, you know, a minus 5, minus 10 with an inch of snow, a dusting of snow is not that big of a deal.
You know, as everybody knows here on Inside the Eye Live, I love ice hockey. But growing up in Southern California, it wasn't something that we really were good at. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't a big sport back when I was growing up, but I've always loved ice hockey.
Yeah, you had the Ducks, I think, since 93 or 4 or 5, something like that. And you have the Kings been around a long time. The Kings have been around a long time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's not a huge sport still in Southern California.
No, it is now.
Some of the successes, yeah.
It is now, actually. It's actually pretty good. You can, back when I was like in the 90s, you started to have a lot of street hockey. You know, people would put on their inline skates and you know, go down to the beach or something where they had the rinks and they would actually set up real hockey, kind of like real hockey, right on the cement. Not the asphalt, of course, because you hurt yourself, you know, with the asphalt, but it would be nice cement and people would play and it'd be pretty fun to watch, actually. Some of them were pretty darn good, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, all you need is a hard surface, some rollerblades, and you can have a good ice hockey, a good, you know, simulated ice hockey match.
Well, I'm just curious, what position did you play?
I was a winger. I was a forward, a winger.
You're not the enforcer?
No, I'm not big enough. Only about 5'8". You got to be a big
like enforcer, man. You didn't look like one. You're too sophisticated for that. You know, you ain't got a barroom brawl nose, okay?
No, I don't. I have been in a fair number of fights, but thus far, I've not had a broken nose. So,
you know, we were talking, you know, lately in America, the big issue, and we discussed this a couple of days ago, is really the Democrats, and unfortunately for those in the Catholic faith, this abortion bill where they are really talking about doing infanticide now, literally on children in America. At least it's now legal in New York, and they tried to pass in Virginia, didn't make it. And then you guys now up in you're not in Ireland, but up in the Irish Republic, they're also celebrating basically infanticide. So you wanted to chime in about that. Where would you like to first start with that? I mean, normally we're in the politics, but
it's been an issue for me. It goes back a few decades because my father, when we were in the U.S., I mean, you can probably tell by my accent, I have a bit of a New York, New Jersey metropolitan accent. My father was actually involved with local politics, and he ran for mayor a few times, not for the city, but for, you know, small towns in New Jersey, northern New Jersey. And he was actually a member of the Right to Life Party. And I recall back in the 1990s when I was a student in high school that my father would talk about this idea that they would try to push partial birth abortion, that it would be, you know, the Jewish lobby, obviously the liberals in the Democratic Party were pushing this idea of partial birth abortion where you could, you know, take the life of a child in the third trimester. And, you know, at the time, my sister was quite liberal, was like, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. And, you know, that would never happen. They just want the right to choose for women, and this, that, and the other. But as we've seen this past week, this past month, they've passed legislation that allows the woman, along with her primary caregiver, doesn't have to be a doctor, to actually take the life of a child if, you know, if it's in her quote interest, which can mean that she's depressed and doesn't want to have the child. So they can kill the child on the operating table when she's dilating. And that's quite shocking. We were told that was a conspiracy theory back in 94, 95, but this has come to, you know, this has come to pass now in 2019. It's quite frightening. And it's, you know, the I see the names behind much of the legislation. And, you know, I didn't want to talk about these sorts of people too much today for obvious reasons. But, you know, the two names I see are Kruger and Schumer. And I doubt either one of these people would be in favor of abortion in Israel. So it is an ugly bill that New York has passed. And it's you know, it's quite vile as someone who has a child and, you know, believes in the sanctity of life. It's very disturbing to think that you could now see children being murdered when they should be delivered.
Yeah. And I don't know if you have it up in the UK, but, you know, I listen to some other radio hosts now too, and you have this Child Protective Services, and here they are literally, if you have the baby, they're trying to basically traffic the child almost immediately after birth. They've got some like 400,000 children in America now under protective care, so to speak. And yet here they're taking oftentimes children from very loving homes. Even if the parents don't have everything going for them, that's okay. None of our parents had everything going for them at the end of the day. This is life. You know, everything is like that. Yet the CPS comes in. They come in. They take the children, traffic the children, put them probably in the hands of abusive people for the purpose of having the children be abused. It's actually worse than that.
Yeah.
And yet here they are. They won't even like protect the life of the child, even when it's about to be born. It's quite shocking, quite frankly.
It is quite shocking. I mean, I don't believe in spanking really. It's not something I do, and I don't think it works. But you can't spank your child, you know, one day after birth, even in a way to, you know, perhaps, you know, quiet him down if they're making, as parents would do in the past. And that's illegal, but you can kill the child a day earlier. It's quite remarkable, the hypocrisy. Like you mentioned, you know, Child Protective Services will snatch children a week after they've been born because the parents decide to name them Adolf or Adolfa. I've seen that. You know, a child being named Goebbels or Adolf, and that child's taken from the parents because they're, you know, evil people. But yet they have no problem sanctioning the murder of a child the day, you know, it's born. It is quite shocking. We live in very dark times, and the only other countries that allow this sort of madness is, you know, China and North Korea. And these are two quite barbaric, you know, nations, you know, quite barbaric regimes. You wouldn't find this in Saudi Arabia. You wouldn't find this in, you know, anywhere in the Middle East.
You would not find that in Saudi Arabia. There's no way.
Yeah, you hear that, you know, how evil these governments are, but yet our own governments are far more vile to allow. And this bastard, and I hate to be rude, but this bastard Cuomo, I mean, his father was governor of New York when I was in the New York metropolitan area, and he was, you know, equally abhorrent. And, you know, these are, you know, phony Catholics. This is a Catholic, apparently, who is sanctioning the murder of an unborn child. Quite shocking. Could just
yeah, 12 Catholic legislators came in on this and voted to pass it. That's absolutely shocking. You know, that would have been when I was, you know, in my teens and before that, that was excommunicatable stuff. And that was a big deal to be excommunicated, you know. And now it's like it's standard policy. It's like the Catholic leadership is just off the rails.
I also read something interesting that there was a case of a couple points I thought was interesting that the left obviously push for abortion, obviously. But, you know, we hear about immigration being the backbone of the left at this point. But, you know, don't they even realize that the vast majority of the children that they're actually killing in New York will be minority children? So I think about 80% of the children that will be aborted in New York City will be Black and Hispanic children. So it is kind of productive for the left. They're obviously ideologues, so they don't really care too much. But I think last year more Black children were killed through abortion than were born. So we had, I think, 35,000-40,000 Black children, I read, were aborted last year in New York, but only 30,000 or so were born in this particular district. I'm not sure which district it was, but I just read that, you know, there were about 5,000 more children murdered than born in this particular district in New York City. That was quite remarkable, I found. And people don't realize that Margaret Sanger, although she's, you know, a hero on the left, she was a eugenicist. She was, you know, I would say national socialist. She believed that whites should be the dominant population in the United States. And I think we probably agree that's for the best. But she believed that the black child was really unwanted, and it was a kind of a would cause problems for society as a whole. And, you know, she is the founder of Planned Parenthood, and she's a hero on the left. But at the same token, she was quite obviously anti-Black. I mean, I recall initially when Planned Parenthood was founded and she was involved, she would talk about the need for having Black receptionists at these practices, because obviously a white woman in the front is not going to sell abortion to a Black mother as well as a Black woman will. So she even said that it's important that we have a Black face at the front desk, so when the Black mother comes in with the child, that she's more likely to abort the baby.
Gotta love sales. Yeah. Gotta love sales.
Yeah, exactly. This is a hero on the left, Margaret Sanger. I mean, she's actually, if you look at her writing and look at the way she thought, she was more, has more in common with us than she does the left. But she's, you know, revered by the left-wing establishment.
You know, the left is kind of like off their rockers, and really they become really more and more insane. I don't even know how to describe these guys. It just looks like it is an ever progressing insanity. I saw one picture yesterday. It showed a guy dressed up as a woman and says, "I am a woman and I need feminism, and that's all you need to know about my gender." And I'm like, what is the, you know what I mean? It really is a mental illness. We are staring at basically the insane rising up into positions of power.
No, I agree. There is something mentally wrong with these people. And, you know, I grew up in the 90s and graduated high school in the late 90s. And I don't remember it being like this. So the first kind of the first time I experienced this sort of left-wing madness in academia was at university. But it was still quite mild. And you could kind of argue with them because they were so foolish. And, you know, the vast majority of the students were still had some common sense. So when you would hear some teacher say something ridiculous, you could kind of laugh and other students would agree with you. But today I've seen that it's, you know, the students are all totally brainwashed, that they kind of go along with everything their left-wing professors say. It is quite remarkable that these sort of people now run the institutions of higher learning. And across the spectrum, whether it's community colleges or state schools, private schools or Ivy League schools, I've seen left-wing professors or dominate pretty much all the institutions of higher learning in the United States. So,
do you know what the value? They've actually already run the value of the late-term abortions for the children in New York. Do you know what basically are the value of that child on the black market?
In terms of body parts?
Yes.
I'm sure it's tens of thousands of dollars. I'm sure
it is. It really is tens of thousands. The brain is going for roughly $23,000. The hearts, 12 fetal hearts. Actually, you need 38 brains to get to the 22,000. 12 fetal hearts will be $7,000. So if you can get 12 hearts, you got $7,000. Livers are $3,000 for five, for every five.
Man. Scary.
Pancreas is 12 fetal pancreases are $7,140. And the upper and lower limbs are I don't know why, maybe because they use that for cosmetics, $2,670.
Yeah. It's quite, I mean, the thing is, people, again, will say this is a conspiracy theory, but if you look at some of the videos on YouTube where they've undercover operatives infiltrate Planned Parenthood and they speak to gynecologists who give these abortions, and they admit that they can get body parts and they will sell them to you. So it's not a conspiracy. I mean, you just Google Planned Parenthood body parts, YouTube Planned Parenthood body parts, and you find videos with doctors selling the parts to customers, you know, out in cafes and coffee shops.
I mean, literally. It's black market stuff. I mean, so between basically what's going on in Israel right now with their black market campaigns, and then this here, you're basically opening up a market for infanticide to make it exceedingly profitable to start killing children.
Yeah, and you have the ideologues, like you said, the crazy people on the left who, you know, will fight for this tooth and nail without realizing that they are really, obviously fighting for the evildoers. It's quite disgusting. But then again, you know, at the same time, you have someone like Chuck Schumer, and he's obviously quite well known in the United States, being an adversary of Donald Trump, a real vile man, Chuck Schumer. And Chuck Schumer is seen as one of the champions of, quote, women's rights in the United States. He's got 100% track record on being pro-abortion. Chuck Schumer is an interesting character because in Israel, he sits on a panel, some kind of think tank panel that fights against abortion in Israel. So obviously in the United States, he's all for abortion. He's pandering.
Does
to the
he really sit on? Is this a private or a government panel in Israel?
I don't know if it's private or government, but I'm assuming obviously it's going to have funding from probably both. But no, he definitely sits on a panel that fights against abortion for the Jewish
people. Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a fact.
Did you see the riots this week in Israel where they went after all these black people?
Doesn't surprise me. I mean, I've seen videos where they call blacks, you know, all sorts of abhorrent names and things that people like you or I would never say, things that you and I would never say. They get away with it. And, you know, they're still seen as, you know, the only democracy in the Middle East. And you know, the way they treat these interesting. At university, I had a when I was at Syracuse, I had an Israeli roommate. He was a Sephardic Jew. He was dark skinned. He was all right. I mean, a bit of a strange character. It wasn't my cup of tea, but, you know, I got along with him. And I remember he told me that when he was in Israel, he was treated abhorrently. And I asked him why. I said, "You're a Jew." And he said, "Well, because I'm brown." And I said, "Well, how badly are you treated?" He said, "Well, I'm treated like almost as bad as a black." He said that they treat white Jews the best. They then treat whites probably second best. And then they probably treat people like me, you know, third, only ahead of the blacks. I said, "It's that bad?" He said, "Yes, it's that bad. They really, you know, mistreat us. We're like third class citizens." And so that racism that, you know, the Jews have, that hatred of, you know, people who aren't like them, is, you know, quite strong.
That's it. Well, actually, we've known about that. It's three tiers. Usually, whenever there were massive bus bombings or something in Israel back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, when they were pushing this meme of terrorists, you know, are everywhere, most of those were false flags, and they targeted tier three Jews. They weren't targeting tier one Jews.
No. Yeah, I mean, this guy was a brown Jew, and he told me point blank.
He was tier two to three, man. He would have been one of those bus riders.
Yeah, he was like Iraqi. I think he had like an Iraqi mother and some kind of a Pakistani or Indian, not joking, father. And he was brown. And, you know, I didn't really look like a Jew, but obviously he was Jewish. And you know, he and I would argue whether, you know, Jewishness was a religion or a race. And he would argue that it was a religion because he was not the same race as them. I would argue it was a race because of the fact that they identify as an ethnic group. But I suppose in some ways he was right because he did not fit into that, you know, Ashkenazi race, obviously. And, you know, he was looked down upon by other Jews.
When you look at the United States, you know, you've obviously got roots in the U.S. equally, and Trump's battle with getting border security. Have you been kind of impressed that he, I mean, what's your opinion, I guess, from the U.K. as this internal battle with basically getting border security for the American people? How are the British handling this? How are they talking about it? What's the views? What are the views relative to the U.K.? You know, where is everybody standing right now on border security?
Most sane people, you know, who would see themselves as right wing or conservative would think, obviously, it's in the interest of the country to protect the borders and protect the people who live in the country from people outside the country. But, you know, obviously, we have crazy people as well who don't care about their fellow man. And they would prefer to see someone murdered in the country by a foreigner than say that the foreigner should be prevented from coming to the country. It's the same sort of dynamic in the UK as the United States, where people on the left would prefer to attack racists than attack murderers coming in from across the border. You know, obviously I'm for a strong border. It makes perfect sense. And one only looks at the crime rates along the Mexican border, and, you know, the vast majority of the crimes committed in Southern California are committed by, you know, illegal migrants, Mexicans who've come over for work, whatever. And it just makes perfect sense to protect the country from these people. It doesn't mean that they're all bad, but it just makes perfect sense to obviously limit their access.
Jack, you travel. Where do you travel and not obey the immigration laws of the countries you travel to? I mean, to me, this is such silly position or posturing by politicians. Like, where do any of these politicians travel and not obey the immigration laws of where they go, including them? Even if they are part of a diplomatic team, they still have to follow the immigration laws of wherever they go. And why should they not expect people coming to their nations to equally follow immigration laws in those countries? This is what I don't get from the political class. They seem
it just unfortunately just pandering to the lowest common denominator in their party. The vast majority of the people who support the Democratic Party in Texas and California and Arizona, unfortunately, have illegals in their families, and they prefer to have, you know, easier access to the country for their family. So it's just a matter of, I think, pandering to the electorate. And it's disgusting, even if it's at the expense of the country. But that's these people are traitors. They're evil. And, you know, the vast majority of these people are white or Jewish. They're not Mexicans or blacks. You know, people like Nancy Pelosi, she doesn't, you know, she's obviously not a Mexican. You know, it's sick. It's disgusting. It's utterly abhorrent. And I remember this horrible story from San Francisco where this poor girl was walking down the boardwalk with her father. And she was just walking with her dad. She was probably in her 30s. And she felt a, you know, some kind of pain in her back or her chest or something like that. And she, you know, leaned forward and there was blood coming out of her. And she'd been shot by an illegal migrant who just found a gun apparently in the dumpster somewhere, who just randomly fired the gun into a crowd of people and killed this poor girl. And, you know, to think that, you know, a politician would allow that to take place in their jurisdiction is just mind-boggling. That this person who committed this crime had been deported, I think, 7 times from what I read. And there was no feeling of failure, you know, as if they'd failed this poor person. Yeah, just apart. I mean, if I was her father, I would have taken out those politicians. And to be honest with you, I would have done that.
Hadn't gotten to that stage yet, but you have to wonder, you know, when, quite frankly, Jack, judges are not going to get visits, politicians are not going to get some visits, journalists are not going to get some visits, because it's clearly out of hand to the point to where there can be no solving it through the political process. Mm-hmm. And once it gets that bad, you just wonder when the people start to take things into their own hand and at least start paying a visit, say, look, your decisions aren't proper. And we get calls to that all the time. You know, your decisions aren't proper. You need to start changing your ways. Jack, hey, we're going into a break, man.
Sure.
Last half hour. It's Jack Sinn, everybody, former UKIP resistance and also with Resistance Radio. And we'll be back right after this. There it is. All right, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware. With Jack Sinn, he's babysitting today, everybody. He's got the daughter. How's the little one, Jack?
She's doing good. Thank you for asking. Just she was enjoying the good country music. She was dancing to it. So.
Oh, that's better than the Oy Vey moment, man.
No, she loves the country music. I'm a big country music fan, actually. So we listen to quite a bit of country here. It's quite odd. I think we're probably the only people in this part of the country that actually play country music. So,
how cool is that, huh? Whoops, I got to cut that. Sorry about that. So anyways, Jack, how are things? Do you know Max Egan at all?
No, I don't know him. I know the name, but I don't know him personally, no.
Oh, he was on this weekend or this past Thursday. We had a great – you should get him on your show. He's pretty good. He's a great guest to have on.
Cool. Thanks for the suggestion.
Yeah, you should bring him. He's an A-lister type of guy. Former BDS – not a former, but a former Palestinian. He used to deal a lot with the Palestinian-Israeli issues, and he stopped doing it really because he just got tired of it, saying that this is that both sides, basically, it's difficult to deal with. So he's off to other things, really dealing with fake history. Great little interview. If everybody didn't catch it on the archives. Nick Griffin, you're still working with Nick Griffin?
Yeah, right now I'm kind of doing two things. I'm running the Resistance Radio. I do that about once every fortnight, a program with Nick Griffin. And I also do a program with Tim Scott, who is he's quite well known in the UK. And in the US, you probably heard of him just via Fox News. He was one of those people, a former soldier who traveled over to the Middle East to fight against ISIS as a private mercenary. And when he returned to the UK, he was arrested for being a terrorist. Because he went over and fought against ISIS, remarkably. And so I do a program with him as well. And he and I run Liberty Defenders together, which is a kind of a veterans rights organization, just fighting for indigenous British people and just for, you know, a better way forward, you know, for Brexit and for our rights to be protected. We fight for civil rights for British people and, you know, fight for a better way. And, you know, you mentioned earlier how things getting over here. One second, Alex, please turn that down. How are things over here? Recently, I was in London. I was at a hotel, and I always stay at this particular hotel. It's in an area of the city that's not too dangerous, but it's, you know, predominantly it's predominantly Indian, Christian, Hindu, Indian. So it's a pretty safe area of the city. And I was up at about 5 a.m. I had to catch a bus to central London. And I was talking to the concierge at the hotel, and I asked him, you know, I can walk to the bus stop, right? He was like, I wouldn't advise it anymore. I said, why is it? We've had 3 stabbings here in the last 6 months. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah, it's changed quite a bit in the last 6 months. And I said, it's only 500 meters from here, the bus stop from the – he's like, no, I would suggest you get a taxi. And I thought to myself, well, what kind of a world do we live in where, you know, I'm not a weak person. I'm a man. I have to take a taxi to go from the hotel to the bus stop, spent £15 on this taxi to go about 500 meters. But I was advised by the – concierge that it was just safer. I was with my little girl and I took the taxi, £15. I just thought to myself, you know, this is not the country I want to live in. I don't want to be I don't want to have to take a taxi to a bus stop from a hotel when I can easily walk it. And that's where we are in the UK now. And something that I could never have envisioned 20 years ago.
Now, Nick Griffin, I think his name popped up over here, believe it or not. Didn't he speak before the European Union, the Parliament?
Did he? I didn't. Recently? I didn't know that. He might have. I mean, he was an MEP. He was obviously in Brussels as a member of European Parliament, but I wasn't aware that he had spoken recently, but it's possible.
Yeah, I could have sworn I saw something. I thought I'd ask you, and now I should have just read the article.
I've had the flu, and I did one program with him when I was sick about 8-10 days ago, but now he didn't mention it. But, you know, it's certainly possible. I mean, he's quite active, obviously, discussing Brexit. You know, he was in the BNP as a member of European Parliament. You know, it would be a Eurosceptic party, and he was one of the leading figures, Eurosceptics in Brussels. But, you know, the European Union controls us. I mean, Brexit is a huge deal. I agree with Nick Griffin on this one, that I don't know if it's as massive a deal as everyone makes it out to, because, you know, we have a lot of problems regardless of whether who governs us, whether it's the European Union or Westminster. And we have a really bad situation in the UK. You know, I would have been no more safe walking to that bus stop if we're in the EU than I would be if we weren't in the EU. That's not going to change whether we stay in the EU or not. Just the demographic change in the capital city, the fact that, you know, only, you know, I'm not fully British and I'm considered British and white. My daughter is only 25% British and she's white. So she's considered British and white, but she and I are, you know, in that 30% of London's population that's still considered British and white. And we're not really British and white fully. So what is that? What's happened to London? It's a city that's now probably at best 10 to 15% British and white. And this is the capital city of the country. Mind-boggling.
I can't imagine that, because, you know, here in Riyadh, we have our pockets of, you know, different ethnic groups for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not like, you know, anybody's taken over Riyadh. You know, it's just no way. You know, I remember here when they deported 400,000 Ethiopians out of Riyadh because of the crime. It just, everybody got fed up with the crime. They said, get out of our country, man. They rounded them up, put them on universities and bust them to 747s and round the clock, basically ferried them out of here on 747s. So it can be done. I mean, if there's a will, there's a way, and it certainly can be done.
Yeah, but then, the Saudis obviously want to protect their country from this. So our government doesn't care. Our government doesn't care. You know, I think they prefer that we're slaughtered in the streets, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is an MP, the leader of the Labour Party. He's an MP in Islington. And, you know, Tim Scott's written to him and said that, you know, he's no longer feels safe walking down the streets of Islington, that there's stabbings on every corner. And he doesn't even get a response. And this is a soldier who served his country writing to his member of parliament, won't even get a response from this white champagne socialist. When he's saying, I don't feel safe in my own community, you know, community that you represent. They don't care about us. They care more, you know, they virtue signal. They care how they look. They don't care about us.
Last time we talked, we discussed that they're really the British for the British natives, you know, the real indigenous British. There's still no real active resistance or opposition to this government inside the British Kingdom, is there?
No. I mean, the French had the yellow vests, and that didn't take root in Britain. You know, there were a few people got involved, and actually it was, you know, friends of mine that actually initiated the yellow vest movement in London. I was not a part of it, although the papers claimed I had something to do with it, and they claimed that Nick Griffin had something to do with it. Yeah, neither one of us had anything to do with it. I literally met with Tim Scott in London at a pub, and he said to me, wouldn't it be cool if the yellow vests took root in London? And I said, that would be kind of cool, wouldn't it? And then one of our friends just basically decided to run with this idea, and he's since been in trouble for it in the UK. And his name is Jamie Goddard.
Goddard, okay.
Yeah.
Is he still in prison, or is he out now?
He's out now, but it's quite interesting. So basically, Jamie, who's just a casual friend of mine, he's not connected to me politically. I know him and we communicate via Facebook, and he's friends with Tim, who I am obviously connected to. And this was just something totally organic and, just off the cuff. He decided to put on a yellow vest, this Jamie Goddard, and approach a member of parliament in Westminster. He called her a Nazi for supporting the European Union. He was arrested for it. The papers, of course, said the Yellow Vest had been hijacked by far-right organizations. They mentioned my name. Had nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, I found out about it from someone who found out about it from the person who was arrested. And he was basically prevented from coming back into the city and told that if he entered the M25 zone, that he would be arrested for, I guess, breaching the peace or something.
Can you imagine, dude, we are watching a situation where people are getting banned from parts of a country?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's almost like we're in the Middle Ages where, you know, they would ban you from certain communities. And if you came back, we've returned to this.
Yeah, yeah. It is remarkable. I mean, the thing is, you know, we had nothing to do with any of it. But it was a good idea that was presented to me at a pub in London by someone who's good friends with this guy. He asked me my opinion on it. I said, what's a good idea? I said, the French have done really well with it. I said that, you know, perhaps Britain can, you know, working class movement in Britain can kind of employ the same tactics and perhaps, you know, pressure the government to do the right thing, to just, you know, kind of follow what the people have demanded from them in voting for Brexit. And this fella, he took it upon himself to go out into the streets and protest. And, you know, he's facing jail time now for basically putting on a yellow vest and shouting, you know, the word Nazi at a politician who's used the word Nazi herself to describe her political enemies. It's quite remarkable that we have absolutely no freedom of speech in this country, like absolutely no freedom of speech. Like in the U.S., you could easily say to a left wing or right wing politician, you're a Nazi, and you would have no problem. But in this country, you cannot say that to someone who has used that epithet herself on numerous occasions. You know, she calls people her enemies, you know, Nazis. And yet, you know, when she's referred to as a Nazi, his basically he was stating that by supporting the European Union, you're supporting the kind of takeover of Britain by Germany. That was his kind of logic. It's kind of flawed logic, but I understand his point. He referred to her as a Nazi because of the fact that she supports kind of German-run European Union. But to be then banned from protesting in London for saying the word Nazi, it's quite remarkable. It is unbelievable.
And that's unbelievable. Yeah. Actually, that's like taking childish stupidity to a steroidal level.
No, it is shocking. And the thing is, it's most peculiar is that, and most hypocritical, is that Nigel Farage, when he was in, he's not a good guy, but when he was in Scotland, he was referred to as Nazi by left-wing protesters outside Scottish Parliament. And the Scottish Parliament said, well, he shouldn't be here. He's a Nazi. And so that was fine, though. You see my point? That was fine. And, you know, the leader of the Scottish National Party had said, well, he doesn't like it. He shouldn't be in Scotland. And that was fine. So left could actually employ the same tactic and get away with it. But, quote, right-wing people in the United Kingdom, in England, cannot employ the same tactic against people they deem, you know, to be, quote, Nazis. But, you know, we live in dark times. I mean,
it's like, man, they can basically tell – they can use whatever words they want, and then you have to – only words they approve for you.
Yeah, yeah. It is very disturbing. I mean, this guy – I know Jamie. He's not a bad guy. He's an – he means well. His heart's in the right place. And, you know, he did this because he believes that the country is being betrayed. And for him to be arrested for this, it's just mind-boggling. And then for them to try to pin this on people like me who had nothing to do with it, absolutely nothing to do with it, because they recognize that maybe I'm more politically astute and I run various organizations, that they can kind of pin it on someone like me and get me into problem. And the lies that they will go to, the extent that they will go to – you know, basically fake news. This story was produced by the Daily Mail and The Guardian. So, you know, major newspapers basically created this story that he was, you know, backed by far right wing shadow organizations, which was all a lie. This guy literally just took it upon himself to put on a yellow vest and go harass an MP. Nothing else. But the papers manufactured this story.
Wow. You know, Paul English, does a lot of kind of different shows around, helped engineer this thing, which we'll have to talk to him why you kept going through there. But he was saying, look, I'm happy there's like the Daily Mail or the Guardian, because they are like our best weapon right now, because they have become so over the top and virtually everything they say, it's just waking people up better than we could ever do doing what we do. You kind of agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I mean, the papers over here are just outrageous. They lie to such an extent, it's just remarkable. I mean, you do have that in the United States as well with, you know, MSNBC and CNN. They just make stuff up. I mean, depending on, you know, which side of the fence they sit on. For example, there was a story about Tommy Robinson that was put out, and we all know Tommy Robinson. If you're genuine about Tommy Robbie Robinson, he's funded by the Jews, American Jews, Zionist Jews. I mean, that's just, you know, obviously at this point, everyone knows he's funded by Horowitz, Shilman, you know, all Jewish people. But The Guardian, who would never say that, because obviously The Guardian's, you know, it's a Zionist operation. They said that he was funded by Russian trolls. They fabricated this story that Tommy Robinson is a creation of the Kremlin. I mean, this is just blatant lie.
They know it's American Jews.
Yeah, I mean, they mentioned Shilman and Horowitz in the article, but the vast majority of the article talked about Tommy Robinson receiving money from a Russian organization linked to the Kremlin. So implying that somehow Putin is behind Tommy Robinson. I mean, it's just the blatant lies.
Wow. Now, you still have some yellow vests, you know, vestiges going on, you know, small stuff going on in like Scotland, don't you, or not really?
I mean, I think that there's some yellow vests, some small movements. I think, some members of the left, you know, the quote working class left, have kind of started marching, against the government, against austerity and things like that. You have some members of the quote right wing that are marching against, you know, Westminster's support of the European Union, but it hasn't taken root as it did in France. I had nothing to do with it, and obviously I don't want anything to do with it. But, I mean, the one of the main reasons I didn't want anything to do with it is because I knew it would never take root in the United Kingdom. I mean, I think that there's just the people don't work together in this country, whereas in France, yeah, the left and the right have their differences, as they do everywhere. But, you know, they both were working against their oppressive government when it came down to the yellow vest movement. So you would see literally on the streets of France, you know, kind of left-wing yellow vest supporters and right-wing yellow vest supporters kind of working in conjunction with one another for the good of the country. Although they had, you know, obviously opposing ideologies, they were wearing the same outfits and they were kind of marching against the state for different reasons. But in the United Kingdom, you know, the two factions were fighting against one another in the streets and, you know, you're a racist or you're that, and it would never work. We're too divided, unfortunately. Like, you know, obviously the yellow vests should be fighting for Brexit because, you know, at the end of the day, the working class people of Britain spoke. They want to leave the European Union. And the yellow vest movement is, you know, it's meant to be a working class movement. That's why they wear yellow vests. They're meant to be workers. But no, I mean, the yellow vest movement in Britain, the vast majority of the left-wing yellow vest wearers were supportive of the European Union. So, unfortunately, it just doesn't work in Britain, you know. So, as Napoleon said, and I hate to say it, it's a nation of shopkeepers. As long as, you know, we have our money and we have our car, then we don't really care. And unfortunately, that appears to be the way it is, that people just don't give a shit. And excuse my language.
Yeah, it's okay. I think we can let that one go through. Yeah. So basically, as we were talking before, the UK still is lost. There's just not a whole lot that can be done for the UK right now. We're watching, I guess, what goes on in Germany a little bit with UK, not the UK, France, Italy. We've seen some good progress, I think, in Italy. Have you followed much with Salvino?
Salvini. Yeah, I think he seems legitimate. And I like some of the things that Di Maio has said about France being behind the migrant crisis and, you know, French kind of neocolonial policy destroying North Africa, obviously the invasion of Libya by NATO and the West destroying kind of the buffer zone that prevented the migrants from, you know, landing on Italian shore is correct. But again, I think that the British people are just totally lost. I think that most people would say that I should just put up with having to take a taxi from the hotel to the bus stop and just suck it up and spend the £15 and, you know, not complain about being fearful of getting stabbed by a migrant. Unfortunately, that's just the way this country is. I mean, you know, with all the Me Too talk and all the, you know, women's rights talk, you know, being fearful that your daughter is going to be groomed by a Muslim is something you have to just accept.
And that's what's really amazing. I don't know who told me, but it's like the British have basically allowed the immersion of their country under this tyrannical type of thing because they were afraid of being called a racist. Maybe you said that, but that's kind of what's happened in the UK.
Oh, it has, for sure. I mean, that was actually in a report that was released about the crisis in Rotherham where grooming gangs were preying upon young white girls. The result was they found that people were scared to talk about it out of fear of being branded racist.
You know, the normalization, we talked about the abortion thing earlier to start the segment here, but there's another very disturbing part of the UK, and that's the like you say, the grooming first of the children by these Islamic gangs. But then you got at the senior elite levels, government that involves themselves in the very dark practice of pedophilia. And Theresa May comes out this week and says something to the effect that pedophiles should be allowed to adopt children. What's the reaction to something like that in the UK?
Yeah, and I hate to say it, but unfortunately, the kind of Anglo-Saxon elites have an unfortunate relationship with pedophilia. There's a lot of pedophilia in the higher, the elite circles in this country. It's quite disturbing. So I don't think there's that much outrage over the Muslim grooming gangs, which is heterosexual pederasty more than pedophilia. It's more, 30-year-old Muslim men looking for relationships with 12, 13, 14-year-old pubescent females. So it's, I wouldn't call it pedophilia, it's more pederasty. But we're talking about, the higher levels of government. There are people that will have sexual relationships with children 5, 6, 7 years of age. And it's quite normal, unfortunately. I mean, there were various scandals at the BBC where presenters and celebrities were having sexual relationships with underage boys, 8, 9 years of age. Even someone like Milo Yiannopoulos, who is a vile character. He's a quote right-wing Brit, but he's openly promoted pederasty between young boys and men. He said that, I think it's something like, cross-generational relationships between, 12-year-old boys and 30-year-old men is perfectly legitimate. And this is a right-wing character who stood on stage with people like, Tommy Robinson. He promotes pederasty, and then he stands on stage criticizing Islam. So it's kind of hard to criticize Islam when you have so much pedophilia in kind of white Britain. And I think that's something that the left have also used to their advantage. So when you obviously criticize grooming gangs, and then someone in the comment section will say, well, what about all the white pedophiles? And, it's kind of hard to argue with that because there is a huge problem with pedophilia in Britain. Homosexual pedophilia is just, it's a lot of it. There's a lot of it.
Yeah, which is why you just generally keep the kids away from these transgender type gay relations. But, they are just adamant, when it comes to protecting their rights to have a family, a normal family, as if that's what they're doing is normal to begin with. It's become quite confusing, quite frankly. Course of Trump, it's like, yeah, right, that's normal. Yeah. Trump declared war on human trafficking, and there's not been a lot of publicity about this. In fact, a lot of different outlets out there want to paint Trump as being just part of the problem. But, I don't know if you heard, but 339 traffickers were arrested just this week in California. 50 children were actually freed in the operation.
Oh, fantastic.
You don't have anything like that going on in the UK at the national level, do you?
No, I just I think that really vile people, the truly vile people in our society are protected. The people that prey upon children, the vast majority of the children who go into care, you mentioned earlier in the conversation in the last half hour, they are sexually assaulted once they're in care. So they're removed from their homes for, quote, alleged abuse, which is probably neglect up. And, neglect and perhaps, trumped up oftentimes. But when they're put into care, they're abused sexually. It's very common for children to be abused sexually when they're in care in this country. It's very, very common. Yeah. So I think the vast majority of children actually who are abused who come out of care were first abused in care, not at home. I mean, the best way to avoid sexual abuse is having a father in the house. The biological father rarely sexually assaults his biological children. That's a very rare occurrence. The vast majority of young girls who are sexually assaulted do not have a father and then are sexually assaulted by someone in a position of power in the government, like a teacher or some kind of a coach or, some kind of a care worker. But the first thing the state does is try to take the father out of the family, the one person who actually prevents sexual abuse. Because if my daughter was going to be sexually abused, I'd be the first person to stop it and probably the first person to, take the person out who did it. But if I was out of the picture, who's there to prevent the child from being sexually assaulted? There's nobody.
Yeah. Did you see the BBC ran a special? They had an American class, but maybe it was a British class talking about how a teacher is indoctrinating 6-year-olds to write love letters to a gay, basically to like a the guy, the prince to wants to marry his servant, you know, and write gay love letters between the two at 6 years old.
It's disturbing. You do see that in Britain, unfortunately, quite a bit. Just, there's something wrong with the minds of the people in charge of our children in this country. There's something seriously mentally wrong with them. I mean, I have a neighbor who has a daughter who's 5-4 years old, and she calls her sexy. And I think to myself, this is just disturbing. She's four. You know, I mean, what kind of why would you say that about your own daughter? I mean, it's something morally abhorrent about someone who describes their four-year-old daughter as sexual. But there's something seriously wrong with them. Find
something for self-esteem other than that at 4 years old.
You would think, right? But
you would think. There's lots of words in our language to come around that's very healthy and uplifting that you can put self-esteem into somebody. You don't need to use that word.
But they have definitely sexualized children in this country. America has as well, but I think there is something slightly more disturbing about it in this country. And I noticed it when I first came back here. I was an adult. I graduated university in the United States and then traveled back to the UK. And I did notice the sexualization of children on television, which I didn't really notice much in the United States. And there's something definitely sick about it over here. It's quite scary.
Yeah. Issues we should probably bring up another day because we're actually out of time, Jack. That's okay. A quick hour. Appreciate you coming on, man, sharing some time. And take care of the little one. Enjoy the day, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks so much, Dennis. I appreciate it. My pleasure.
All right, thanks. That's Jack Sen, everybody. Former UKIP party member and also behind Resistance Radio. Check out his site, resistanceradioithink.com. We'll get the links on the site. Thanks again for listening, everybody, Inside the Eye Live for Saturday.
Take care.
See you all later. Good evening.